On Tech News Today, new Windows 10 laptops are cheaper than Chromebooks. Plus, Apple denies reports that it's becoming a wireless carrier. And we'll tell you about the latest vehicle hijacked by hackers. All that and more coming right up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, August 4th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. Tech News Today is a show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin. Our co-anchor today is After Nine's content czar, Joe Panettiere. Hey, Joe, how you doing?
Doing fantastic, Mike. How's your week going?
It's going great. Now, you are not in the great state of New York. You are in the other California, Florida, today. What are you doing in Florida?
Yeah. I'm battling a lot of rain, actually. No, my in-laws live down here, so we're down visiting, having a nice relaxing time, and we may go on to Busch Gardens, Tampa, if that dries out in time for a visit.
Yeah, we'll bring your inflatable dinghy because it's torrential rains there, so as is usually the case in Florida, often the case, I should say. Well, Joe, we have tons of great news and three fantastic guests. So why don't we jump right into the news? The Electronic Frontier Foundation and a few other companies have announced a new do not track setting for online advertising. Ginny Marvin is a reporter for MarketingLand and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Ginny.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on again. Now, first of all, why is the EFF doing this? I mean, why the EFF? Isn't this the job of dedicated privacy groups and the companies that make ad software?
Well, yeah. So this is sort of a long, long-winded story. So the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium, actually has been the one sort of spearheading this. The problem is no one can agree on an actual standard and or to agree to adhere to a standard. So the EFF has essentially taken this into their own hands and said, look, we're going to have a stronger policy here and get a group of web companies to buy in with us on this. So they've got Adblock, Mixpanel, which is an analytics software platform, Medium, the content site, and DuckDuckGo, the privacy-oriented search engine, are all tied in on this and saying that they're going to adhere. So the what the EFF is saying is this is going to be stronger and a better policy for users. How exactly that's going to happen is a little bit hard to piece together. What they are saying is that the standard's best used with other privacy type software that that users can get. But so that's sort of the long-winded answer to your question.
Hey, Ginny, in terms of how this will work for the end user, is this built right into the browser or does it have to do with search engines? How does it work for the end user who doesn't want to be tracked?
Right, great question. So it works the same way. So it's basically a header request in your browser. So whether that's Chrome or Firefox, when you go to the options section in your browser, you can say, you know, don't track me. Or I think it's something like that the language is there under the privacy settings within your browser. So what that's supposed to do is tell the sites that you visit that please don't track me. And this is where it gets a little bit fuzzy because whether the site themselves tracks you or whether they pass that on your data onto all the kind of networks, ad exchanges, all those third parties that are engaging on that site through advertising and targeting ads with your data, it sort of gets that murky water happens as soon as you visit a site because you're obviously not just visiting Yahoo. You're, all those ad networks are plugged in there as well. So that's sort of where this gets muddy. And so Yahoo, what the EFF is saying is the sites themselves shouldn't be tracking. If they want to get consent to have that and share it with third parties, that's still feasible. So that's kind of how that all works. But it really, it's a setting in the browser.
And this is routinely ignored by the big ad companies, right? I mean, don't they just say, we don't believe in this? What are their reasons for ignoring what users clearly want?
Yeah, so the main thing you'll hear, so it's not in their best interest as a business proposition necessarily to be adhering to do not track when their businesses are based on serving personalized, targeted ads. So that's obviously the business case for it. What the companies like Yahoo and Google will argue is that consumers have no idea what do not track actually means. And they're confused by it. So actually, what they'll say is that users want targeted ads, and they don't understand that saying do not track means they won't get targeted ads. So we're just going to ignore their signal to say that they don't want to be tracked.
That sounds like what the GMO labeling argument is all about. Oh, we can't put GMO right on the label because customers can't be trusted to know what that means. And therefore, exactly, we shouldn't tell them.
Yes, exactly. Yes. We will ignore their supposed wishes because they don't actually understand what they're wishing for.
Yeah. So, hey, Jenny, a follow-up question when it comes to media companies. Hypothetically speaking, say I ran a media website, right, that included advertising on it. Could I control this do not follow, do not sort of disturb, do not track capability? Or is it really the ad network and up to the ad network that's plugged into the system whether or not to control this?
Great question. And it depends. So it is, that's I think really where the murkiness gets. So it's kind of up to everyone. And so what happens a lot of times is the ad networks would say, well, I got consent from this user when they were on another site. So now that they're on your site that you've said do not track, you want to adhere to do not track, well, they're already my user. I basically already have their consent, so I'm still going to use their data. So you can see where this big circle gets really messy.
Murkiness is what online advertising is all about, I guess. You know, what I want personally is I want to go ahead and track button, but give me relevant advertising, for crying out loud. I'm giving you all my data. Give me something. So that's just me. I'm probably in the minority. Ginny Marvin is at marketingland.com and on Twitter at Ginny Marvin. Ginny is spelled G-I-N-N-Y. Thank you so much for joining us today, Ginny.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. We got some more news for you coming right up. But first, let's talk about Gazelle, which you know is the place to sell your device. You got old devices sitting around. You know you got to sell it to Gazelle because it can give you really, really good money for it. And you can use that money to buy your next gadget. And when you buy that next gadget, guess where you should go to buy it? To Gazelle, because they sell certified pre-owned devices, Samsung Galaxy phones, iPhones, iPads. You name it, they sell it. And if you've got a budget, which we all do, of course, you can get more phone or more tablet for your money by going to Gazelle. You can get a device that is indistinguishable from a brand new device. The only difference is that it costs less. And that is a very, very good thing. You just go there and pick your device and buy it. Each device is certified and backed by a 30-day risk-free return policy. You just get so much phone for the money. And if you want to get even more phone or tablet for the money, you can get a certified good category of device. That means there may be some gentle signs of wear, but it works perfectly. Of course, they put everything through a rigorous 30-point inspection to make sure that everything works perfectly. Find out what your iPhone's worth. Take a minute and go to gazelle.com to find out. That's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. And we thank Gazelle for their support of Tech News Today. Acer today launched a new Aspire 1 Cloudbook line of laptops. They run Windows 10, but they're priced like Chromebooks. Sherlyn Lowe is a staff writer for Tom's Guide and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Sherlyn.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Now, can you tell us about the lower-priced version of this line, the Chromebook 11, starting with the price?
The Acer Cloudbook 11, actually, it starts at $169. That's pretty crazy. You get 16 gigabytes of storage. You get Windows 10, Intel Celeron power, a 1366 by 768 display, which is, you know, pretty common on, you know, laptops of this price, as well as Chromebooks, and a whole bunch of other connectivity options, such as USB 3, USB 2. Acer is actually touting its 802.11ac wireless technology in this laptop, which is supposed to support higher Wi-Fi speeds when paired with an AC-enabled router. Most lay people probably won't really know what this means, but make sure you get the routers with AC power so that, AC wireless technology, so you get better streaming speeds. That's important because a lot of the cloud books will depend on online storage. So that's where cloud and cloud books comes from. It's going to come with at least the 16 gigs models will come with 100 gigs of OneDrive storage, as well as a 1 year subscription to Office 365, which is basically Microsoft Office, but online. And the 32 gigs and 64 gig versions of the cloud books will come with 1 terabyte of storage on OneDrive. So that's a whole lot of space.
Hey, Shirlin, can you explain sort of the cloud setup to me a little bit more and also the pricing structure here? Because the reason I ask is when Chromebooks first came along, Microsoft really criticized them, basically telling users, hey, you know, what if you lose internet connectivity? And also, good old Microsoft Office isn't available on these Chromebooks. And now the Cloudbook comes along and we're talking about Office 365. Is everything running up in the cloud? Or is there some local processing going on? And how does Microsoft really hit the price here? I mean, is Windows 10 basically shipping for free on this to Acer?
Yeah, so Windows 10 is going to be a free upgrade to basically everyone who has Windows 7 and Windows 8 already. And Microsoft was making the OS free to a bunch of OEMs to kind of spur the manufacturing of these Windows laptops because they were really taking a hit from Chromebooks. Now, Windows 10 in the Cloudbook is going to run as a full operating system on the laptop, and the online portion of it would just be, I believe, the Office 365 and the storage, because 64 gigs and 32 gigs are really not much for a full laptop. So you're going to want to keep your documents like your movies and your, you know, files on the cloud so that you free up some space in your computer for apps. You can also install full programs such as Adobe Photoshop once that version is available for Windows 10, or even Microsoft Office for the desktop, which is not dependent on an online connection, if you wish. But that would be really, the performance would be limited to the kind of processing power the Intel Celeron CPU would provide, as well as the very little 2 gigs of RAM and the amount of storage you have. So there are limits. But you can run offline if you wish. And I think, to me at least, that is a lot more appealing than Chromebooks, because a lot of Chrome OS is still very dependent on an online connection, even though it's already been working on expanding its offline app selection. So it's really...
You know, the thing with Chromebooks, though, is not that good programs can't run locally. It's that bad programs can't run locally. In other words, they're extremely secure because it's not a system for downloading whatever and running it locally. It's everything's in the cloud. This seems to have the downsides of Chromebooks plus the downside of Windows, which is a lack of security. Is this going to make sense to consumers out there, or do you think that there's a market for this?
I think that there is a market for this. I think even though, like you mentioned, rightly so, the downsides of it are there, I think the price is unbeatable. It's really, really cheap. And, you know, of course, if you install Norton, you know, some kind of antivirus program on it, it might take up half your computer space. But you're still going to appreciate having such a cheap portable laptop on the go and run Windows. I think the beauty of it also is that Windows 10 supports Cortana, and it's so nice to get the desktop assistant at such a great value. Again, it's $169 starting price for the 11-inch version and $199 starting price for the 14-inch model. So these are, I mean, I haven't heard of something as cheap in a long time.
Yeah, just to put that in the context, the 14-inch model is the same price as Windows 10 Pro. By itself, with no hardware.
Itself, yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy at all, like completely.
Yeah. Hey, Sherlyn, do you expect the CloudBook brand, is that an Acer brand, or is this going to be an industry, sort of how Chromebook is a brand that multiple laptop makers have backed now? Do you think CloudBook will become some sort of brand for Windows 10 cloud-enabled devices?
No, not at all. This is an Acer thing because HP's already made its Stream 11 and laptop, which also runs basically Windows 8 for now, but it's also a budget Windows laptop. So these have been around a while. It's just that, you know, Acer's now kind of the first to launch such a device with Windows 10 at this price. So I don't think that CloudBook, in fact, I think Acer might even own the name, I'm not sure. Whereas Chromebook was owned by Google, and then it teamed up with OEMs to make different Chromebooks. So CloudBooks aren't going to, I don't think they're going to become a thing we say very often in the future, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, you know, this is really an interesting play by Microsoft and you know, for them to contribute, essentially donate Windows
yeah.
to this effort. But it's great. I mean, for these price, I mean, people spend that, you know, go out to dinner and spend that much money. You know, it's such a low price that people who might have, work at a place where somebody's using, you know, the company's using a Microsoft application or, you know, in the case of Joe and I and you, we you know, a lot of us work for editors who demand, you know, a Microsoft Word documents, which you can create with Google Docs, but still they send you back a Word doc and you can't really open it. So it's really a brilliant play, I think, and we'll see if it really takes off. It's a great showcase, great way for people to try Windows 10 without spending much money. Sherlyn Lowe is at tomsguide.com. You can follow her on Twitter at Sherlyn Lowe. Sherlyn is spelled Cherlynn. Low is LOW. Thank you so much for joining us today, Sherlyn.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
ThinkUp has launched its new site, MakerBase, which exists to keep track of the people who make digital projects. You can look up people and see all the projects they were involved with, or you can look up projects and see all the people who contributed to them. Full disclosure, ThinkUp is run by Anil Dash and Gina Trapani. And Gina, of course, is a longtime host and guest here on the TWiT Network. Kwame Opem is news editor for The Verge and joins us to talk about this. Welcome to the show, Kwame.
Hi, happy to be there.
Now, I'm so glad you're here again. Now, this is a really interesting project. You know, Gina's been telling us about this for some time, dropping little hints here and there. But from your perspective, why did ThinkUp, or what did Anil actually tell you as to why ThinkUp created this? What problem are they trying to solve?
So it's a pretty basic problem of not really knowing who's behind the people who are making the web work. So the analogy he used was, you look at the movie credits as the credits go by after a movie, and you can figure out who made the movie, the best boy, what have you. And you can look at the liner notes of any piece of music that you like and figure out who was actually part of the production. But the problem with web properties is, apart from the bigger people like Mark Zuckerberg, you were not going to actually know who actually made those products. So MakerBase kind of takes down the pall of letting people figure out who's actually making these things that we use every day, the apps, the podcasts, what have you. And it's pretty cool. It's actually very simple in how it functions. You just look at the website and you search for, say, Pinterest or anything that you want, really. And you'll see like who's been collaborating, who have built it, who helped promote it, that sort of thing. And it's very easy to use.
Hey, Kwame, where does all the data come from? How are they crowdsourcing this? What's the approach?
It's basically crowdsourced. So they soft launched in January and they got a small group of maybe a dozen people to help out. And since then, it's kind of ballooned to a couple hundred people who are contributing all this information about themselves. So in that way, it's kind of a LinkedIn or IMDb of who's programming or building the internet as we use it. It's not like pulled via algorithm. It's all people very organically kind of putting this information in.
How much do we know at this point about the mechanism to handle things like conflicting information? For example, two people might say, I did this project, and the other one says, no, I did it, and they get into this war. Is there some mechanism, are there moderators, for example, that can resolve conflicts in the crowdsourced data?
The best of that I can tell, it's actually very simple. It works basically like a wiki. So people who are putting up their information, it's number one, supposed to be as simple as possible. All the information that pertains to a person's position doesn't really have anything to do with their hierarchical position, but really just what they did. So it could be as simple as I helped build Twitter, and that will be it. So if someone has conflicting information, another person can go in and edit it as they see fit, and there can be a kind of collaboration about how people go forward, about how they talk about what they're doing and when they did it.
Hey, Kwame, is this now open to all? In other words, could I go out there and start putting in projects that I've been involved in?
Absolutely. It launched this morning at 6 a.m. actually at the White House. It's actually part of the White House's demo day. And you can literally sign up right now on Twitter and just start putting in whatever you've been working on up until this point. So it's immediately open and very easy to use as of right now.
And you mentioned demo day in your article. What is demo day exactly?
So demo day was announced back in March by the Obama White House. And it's an initiative to have people from all walks of life, including Silicon Valley, as well as anyone from any walk of life, particularly women and people of color, to show off what they've been working on and connect with other people in ways that they may not have been able to do so before. So the initiative is happening at the White House. You have, along with Makerbase, other companies like Duolingo, along with other startups and small companies that people like veterans have been working on to get their voices out there and get people involved and get people interested in what they're working on.
And this begins at 1:30, so this starts in 4 minutes, demo day at the White House. So we're going to be seeing news later on today about that. Kwame Opam is at TheVerge.com and on Twitter at Kwame Opam. Let me spell that for you. It's KwameOpam. Thank you so much for joining us today, Kwame.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We told you yesterday about an exclusive on Business Insider saying that Apple is in talks to become a mobile virtual network operator, or MVNO. Today, Apple's denying the report. A spokesperson said, quote, "We have not discussed, nor do we have any plans to launch an MVNO. Joe Panettiere, come on, they've never even discussed this. I find that hard to believe."
Well, it is really interesting, Mike, because usually Apple and companies of that type will say no comment. Even if they're not involved in something like this, they'll say no comment because they just don't want to set a precedent of offering any type of tip of what they're up to. And so I thought this was a really strong statement from Apple, and a rare one at that.
Yeah. And Business Insider, the same reporter, had a separate story in the same at the same time, basically, all from sources. They may have been the same sources. In fact, that would be my guess. Again, this is just guesswork at this point. But they also reported that Apple was planning to roll out a Siri-based voice messaging transcription service. So somebody calls you, Siri answers the phone. Mike isn't available right now. Would you like to leave a message? You leave a message, and then Siri transcribes that into text and then plunks it either into your iPhone app, the phone app on your iPhone, or emails it to you or whatever. There was kind of vague on that point. But if you have doubts now about the MVNO story, you may also want to extend those doubts to the Siri transcription service story. They both seem to have come at the same time, possibly from the same sources. And so, you know, I just want to make sure that you have skepticism if you want to have skepticism about that. Well, in product update news, YouTube today rolled out a new design for watching videos in a desktop browser. The new design has see-through control panels that sit on top of the video instead of underneath. Joe, one of the benefits of this is that instead of the tiny little controls, they're much bigger controls because they're not limited to just what's underneath. Now, those are the old controls. Those are the old controls. Those are the new ones. Okay, you got a high-resolution screen there, so they look pretty large.
Yeah, no, hey, listen, anything that gives us more real estate in terms of how we're navigating is a good thing in my mind.
Yeah, it's much easier to use. And, you know, I think that it's also something that's more friendly if you're using a touch device from a browser, like, for example, you know, one of the new touch PCs or touch Chrome bases. Well, in an exclusive, BuzzFeed reported yesterday that Twitter is preparing to add a news tab to its iOS and Android apps. A Twitter spokesperson says it's an experiment, but the feature has already gone live in Japan. When you click on the new tab, you get stories from major news organizations selected by Twitter. Tapping on a story, you get the article plus top tweets related to that story. Everybody, Joe Panettiere, wants to be a news app now, including Twitter.
Yeah, they sure do. They sure do. And you got to wonder a little bit in terms of how is Twitter choosing this content? And also, will it be pay-per-play? Will Twitter basically go out to various news organizations and say, if you want to be front and center in this feed, you have to pay up? And it also reminds us all of what Facebook is up to in terms of instant articles. It's certainly a different strategy, but to your point, Mike, it's all about news. Even though news is a commodity, it drives so much readership.
It absolutely does. And the social networks are really in a position of power here, especially Facebook. When they rolled out their instant articles, they had 9 partners. And you really want to be one of those partners. I mean, Facebook has 1.5 billion users. And one of the biggest usages of Facebook is reading news, sharing news, and so on. So it's a very, very powerful thing. And you know, social networks are the new arbiters of what's news, what isn't news, and so on. So we'll see where this goes on Twitter. And of course, you know, Twitter's Project Lightning, we expect to be a much more, much richer, human curated, all-inclusive tab site, something. It's going to be an offering that's part of Twitter that will give you all kinds of information, video, you know, multimedia information on not just news, but events, you know, the Oscars, whatever. So everybody's going to be competing for these spaces to get the eyeballs when people pay attention to current events or whatever. Well, in product obituary news, a startup called Matchstick, which launched a Kickstarter to build an alternative to Google's Chromecast, said yesterday they'll offer refunds instead of shipping the product. The company was unable to overcome digital rights management issues associated with such a device, or at least they say that's what they said. The Matchstick was designed to run Firefox OS instead of Chrome. The campaign raised almost $500,000 from more than 17,000 backers. Man, bummer. This looked like a kind of a cool product.
It did look cool. The thing that concerned me here, and it's I have this over and over again with crowdsourcing, it's the due diligence. How do I do due diligence on a company that may have some really cool, interesting technology, and the only financial information available is how much money they've raised on the crowdsourcing site? That is a tricky situation going forward for venture funding overall.
It certainly is, and at least it looks like they're not just, you know, taking the money and running off to Argentina or something like that. They're actually going to be giving it back, and that's the right thing to do. So hopefully they'll have a more successful project in the future, and also give some fodder to the anti-DRM folks, because it really shouldn't be that hard to do something like this. Well, I've got some more news for you coming right up. But first, let's talk about delicious food, my second favorite topic after technology. I love good food, and that's why Blue Apron is such a wonderful thing around my house. Now, I'm really lucky because my wife is the greatest cook ever, and it's a bummer for her to have to do all the cooking just because she's so good at it. So sometimes I get to do the cooking when Blue Apron is around, and she gets a great meal. And also, she doesn't have to do all the work. And the truth is that Blue Apron is really not a lot of work. It's a lot of fun because, you know, for me personally, the thing that I find stressful about cooking is you have so many things going, you have multiple dishes going at the same time. And it's like, you have to keep track of one and you pay attention to one thing and the other thing burns. And then while you're dealing with the thing burning, then something else is, you know, and so it can be very challenging. But Blue Apron, the way they do their instructions, which are really simple step-by-step instructions, you cook everything at once. And it's very simple, very easy to follow. And you can do the whole thing, the whole meal, in about a half an hour, 35 minutes, something like that. And each meal is 500 to 700 calories. Now, another great thing about Blue Apron is you're going to be doing dishes that you might not normally do. Most people have a pretty narrow repertoire of what types of food they're comfortable making. So the current, this week's current meals are, for example, Mexican-style chicken tortas with tomato, avocado, and cucumber salad. Would you make that on your own? I mean, I wouldn't. Soba noodle salad. Would you make that? Or would you just like to say, yeah, well, let's make some soba noodle salad? No, most people wouldn't. It's kind of an interesting idea, and it's a you know, in that case, it's probably a very Japanese influenced dish, and Blue Apron just sends it right to your door, and you just follow the instructions. You end up with these really, really interesting, delicious, always delicious meals that you wouldn't think of otherwise to make. So Blue Apron is just a better way to cook. Check out this week's menu and get your first 2 meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's right, 2 meals free. I want you to do it right now. Get those 2 free meals. Just go to blueapron.com/twit, and we thank Blue Apron for their support of Tech News Today. Well, in news you could lose, it seems like everything is getting hacked these days, including cars, rifles, and even safes. The latest stunt involves hacking a skateboard, and no, I'm not kidding. As with most of these high-profile takeover hacks, this one also comes from Wired. Let's watch their video and brace yourself. the first ever skateboard that got hacked.
It turns out those electric skateboards could be even more dangerous than they look. Hackers have found a way to control them remotely, leaving a rider in the lurch.
So a boosted skateboard,
it looks like the alley behind Twit.
Electric vehicle that's in the shape of a longboard. They go about 22 miles per hour with a range of 5 miles or so. You control the skateboard using this handheld wireless controller here. It's got a little throttle wheel.
First of all,
on it,
I want this skateboard.
Wheels go faster and slower.
Security researchers Richard Healy and Mike Ryan can hack into the controller's Bluetooth and take over.
Richo actually rides this every day as his daily commuting vehicle, and we were curious as to how secure it was. We found it was using Bluetooth Smart, or BLE, and it also turns out that they weren't using encryption. So we
can't believe they didn't encrypt the skateboard, Joe.
And then we reverse engineered the protocol.
Why would you buy a skateboard that wasn't encrypted?
Yeah, there should be some sort of logo on the box.
The connection between the user's handheld controller and the skateboard.
There should be a Bluetooth dumb label.
Connect to the skateboard.
You know, I love wires. The Internet of Things, you just got to assume they're going to go out and everything that can, in some way, they're going to go hack.
They're going to hack everything alphabetically. It's just like, it's open season. And, you know,
in all the cases where Mike and I have done this,
you know, it's really kind of a D-bag move to, like, somebody's on a skateboard and just hit it, put it, throw it in reverse. Yeah, okay, all right, I get the idea. It's got Bluetooth. It's not encrypted. And, yes, you can hack it. So, very, very fun. I can't wait to see what they hack next. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Edward Coscanetto in Houston, Texas, who posted this picture on Twitter. He's listening to Thursday's show while upgrading all the machines in his studio to Windows 10. Brave, brave man. Show us how you want. No, that's not a slam against Windows 10, by the way, just to do them all at once. You want to save one, just in case. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Joe Panettiere, are you going to continue your vacation? I know your regular vacation isn't as fun as co-anchoring this show, but are you going to try to have fun anyway?
Yeah, I'm going to try and have some fun anyway. We're definitely heading down to Busch Gardens, Tampa tomorrow, so that'll be some fun. And I'll be back in the home office for next week's show.
All right, wonderful. We will see you next week.
Take care, Mike.
All right, bye-bye. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on Feedly, or you can choose another way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. And if you're ever in the greater Petaluma area, come on in and watch us as part of our studio audience. I'll show you the alley. You'll see that looks just like the alley we just saw in that video. Send email to tickets@twit.tv before you come in. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/TechNewsTodayTV. And you can follow me at elgin.com. And don't miss our other news show, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. Tonight's guest is VentureBeat's Ruth Reeder. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the Tech News Today. This show was produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Tony Wang. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.